Who is Tom Bombadil? In all of the Middle-earth legendarium, there is no other figure as puzzling and strange. From his interactions with Old Man Willow to his relationship with the One Ring, Tom proves he is one of the most powerful beings in Middle-earth. But where did he come from? And what is his significance for the larger story? Join us as we explore the Bombadil Enigma. The Tolkien Road, Episode 216, The Bombadil Enigma, an interview with Keith Matheson. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 216. Greta.
Hey.
How are you?
Hey, John. I'm super fantastic. How are you?
I am doing pretty darn well.
That's good.
Excited for another amazing episode of The Tolkien Road.
I know.
The podcast for Tolkien lovers.
Ravenous Tolkien fans.
All you Tolkien likers.
No, we're not going to do that again. We're not doing that again.
That's my thing. This is the podcast for Tolkien lovers right here. So all you people who are like, oh yeah, I'm Tolkien. I like me a Tolkien story every now and then.
Mm-mm. Johnny.
You got to be utterly devoted, slavishly devoted to Tolkien to be worthy of listening to this podcast.
Okay. You can stop laying down now. We've established the fact that you're a Tolkien nerd, but we welcome all here. All are welcome.
What are you?
Okay. You know,
I never should have hired you for this job. I can't get rid of you.
You can fire me anytime.
No, it's impossible.
It's
people
true.
Would just stop listening.
They would stop listening. You know, you'd be nothing without me.
Well,
mm-hmm. True. Yeah,
maybe.
Okay.
On this episode, we are joined. On this episode, we are joined by Keith Matheson. Earlier this year, Keith published an article on his blog entitled "The Bombadil Enigma." It's a fascinating exploration of what we know about Tom Bombadil, and Keith's theory on the meaning of Tom Bombadil is one we think you'll find very interesting.
I found it very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, honestly, like, you know, I enjoy being the other half of this podcast. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some...
The Tolkien liker part of this podcast?
The Tolkien liker, yes. I stand up for the Tolkien likers out there. You're welcome.
The mere
but
Tolkien likers.
I will say that, you know, there's some episodes that, you know, like, they're fine. They're good. Like, it was, you know, not a complete waste of my time to mm-hmm. be a part of it. But this episode, like, y'all have to listen. So good. Tom Bombadil is, like, he's fascinating in so many ways. And Keith knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So y'all best tune in.
Absolutely.
Keep listening.
Yeah, we pre-recorded the interview.
And oh,
it was
yes.
a very, it was a highly... highly enjoyable discussion. Keith, we really enjoyed chatting with Keith, mm-hmm. and we think you'll enjoy it too.
Yeah, you will, for sure.
Special thanks to this episode's executive producer, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, and a shout out to all of our amazing patrons.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you all so much for supporting this show. If you are not a patron, you should become a patron. Support us on Patreon. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks like early access to new episodes and more. Head on over to patreon.com/Tolkien Road to find out the deets. And you can also support us by an episode via tip jar. You can go to the web. You can go to TolkienRoad.com, find the episode that you really enjoyed and leave a tip for that particular episode. And then last but not least, support us by subscribing, rating, and reviewing on iTunes. All three of those things, right? Hit that subscribe button, rate us, and review us, or whatever you listen. If you're listening on Spotify, do the equivalent over there on Spotify, right? Whatever platform you listen on, subscribe, rate, and review. All three of those things. You know, when you go all out and you go and you give that 5 stars, and then you give us that glowing review, that tells the AI, the algorithms, that this is a worthy podcast.
Mm-hmm. So, which we are.
Which we are, of course.
So. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, not a lot in the world of Tolkien news as of late. So.
Maybe that's good.
Well, I think we just, you know, a couple episodes, we probably single-handedly convinced Latron Prime mm-hmm. to, you know, maybe rethink it all again and You know, so I'm sure they're just back to the drawing board.
I'm sure.
So
yeah, they're just too busy to put anything out there.
It's the most likely explanation.
Most likely.
All right. Okay, Greta, let's talk about the Bombadil Enigma, shall we?
Let's do it. Yes.
All right, we're joined on this episode by Keith Matheson. A few months ago, Keith sent me an article he had written on Tom Bombadil, and I thought it was such a well-done exploration of the character and the controversy surrounding him that I invited Keith to join us for an episode of The Tolkien Road. So, Keith, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Nice to have you here.
Yes, thanks for being here.
So, Keith, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was born and raised in Texas. I've been in Florida since 1992, the last 10 years teaching at a little Christian college in Central Florida. Have a wife, an adult daughter with a granddaughter, have a son, 19, in college. I'm a Texan in exile, basically.
Okay. Gotcha.
I've heard that you can take the Texan out of Texas, but you can't take the Texas out of the Texan. We have a lot of friends from Texas, and
this
sticks with them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, tell us about your journey as a Tolkien fan. Whenever we have anybody on, we always want to hear, you know, before we talk about the substance of why we're having them on, you know, we're really a fan focused podcast first and foremost, and you know, ravenous fans. And so I think I can tell from some of the things, you know, from this article and from some of the other things that you've written, that you seem to be fit that profile pretty well of being a ravenous Tolkien fan. So tell us about your journey as a Tolkien fan, Keith.
I am a ravenous fan. I was a latecomer to Tolkien. We didn't have a lot of books in my house growing up, but we had the an encyclopedia set, and for some reason we had the complete works of Edgar Allan Poe. So I was either reading encyclopedia articles or giving myself nightmares. I first encountered Tolkien's writings. I remember walking through bookstores back when I was a teenager and young adult and seeing Tolkien in the section and seeing that title, The Lord of the Rings, but for some reason it never clicked to me that I should read that. And then I don't remember why I first picked that book up, but I brought The Lord of the Rings home one day and decided I wanted to read this, and just started reading it and quickly fell in love with it and almost immediately reread the whole thing. And I just remember this book hitting me harder than almost any other fiction book did. It really hit me in the heart. Mm. And I just fell in love with it and began reading more and more of Tolkien's works. And finally, I read The Hobbit for the first time as an adult, came to that after Lord of the Rings. Mm. Found The Silmarillion, started to look at other smaller works of Tolkien, and just got more and more involved. And then the movies, of course, came out. And in 2001 or so, I think that was the first one, 2001, and I went and saw those. Have a love-hate relationship with them. And then a few years ago, I had the opportunity, the students petitioned, since I knew what a rabid Tolkien fan I was, the students at my little college petitioned the administration if they could have a Tolkien class. And so I was asked to teach on the great works of Tolkien. And I'm not a Tolkien scholar, but it was just basically a big classroom of fans with me leading the fan discussion.
Yeah.
And then I was asked again this year if I would do it. So I'm in the middle of that class again this semester and learned a little bit more about it. But I fell in love with Tolkien maybe 20 years ago. I think I encountered him in my late 20s or early 30s, and have just been pursuing reading secondary sources, finally started working on the history of Middle Earth and things like that. And
yeah,
just love it more and more every time I read it.
Well, if you're not a Tolkien scholar, Keith, then you sure do a good job of faking it. So
yeah. You're a good impersonator.
Yeah.
Just a really intense Tolkien fan.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that's how a lot of, I feel like there's a lot of people who are maybe like, you know, I know in my case, I've written two books on Tolkien, but I never can feel like I'm worthy of calling myself a Tolkien scholar, because it just seems like nobody really matches up to that that description. I think it feels like being the true sense of being like a scholar, in the sense of like, if you're going to be, you're more like just a constant student, you know, just trying to better learn what he was all about and what he wrote.
Well, when I say Tolkien scholar, the people in my mind are people like Tom Shippey and Wayne Hammond and Christina Scull.
There are definitely a few that are, you know, of a higher tier for sure. So, but yeah, like I said, you do based on just this article alone, you do a pretty good job of faking it. So, mm-hmm. Great. That's interesting. So Lord of the Rings was first for you, and then The Hobbit sometime later, yes. and then The Silmarillion and all other things. Yeah. So very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yes.
All right. Well, Keith, what inspired this article on Tom Bombadil?
Well, the first time I read Lord of the Rings, Tom Bombadil just stood out as odd. Mm-hmm. It was just a really, really odd thing. Even that, it wasn't very far into the book, but when you run into him, he just strikes you as an unusual character. And then it moves back into this deep medieval type fantasy again, and there's nothing else quite like him in that whole book. And so I became intrigued by him the first time I read the book, and every time I read it, I was more and more intrigued. And the more I learned about Middle Earth and the whole, all the creatures and types of beings that exist in Middle Earth, the question just started to arise in my mind: what is he? Who and what is he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's when I started doing searches for articles online and elsewhere to see, has anybody else thought about this? And I just ran across so many theories about who and what he was. And it's just been a kind of a hobby, I guess you would call it. It's like a fun little mystery, a puzzle to try to solve.
Riddle.
It's like it's like a subcategory of Tolkien scholarship is Bombadilology.
I think so. So I've been just fascinated with all the various theories out there for the last two decades, and more recently when I prepared to write this, what caused me to write this was, for a long time I was just interested in this, and I had noticed certain things, and I know we'll talk about that a little bit more, but I guess it was about 6 months ago, something clicked and it hit me that all these pieces started to come together when I ran across this one little item that in my mind turned a lot of circumstantial evidence into potentially something more significant.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, let's dive into your article. Your article is entitled, let's see, I had it pulled up. There we go. The Bombadil Enigma. I thought it was the Bombadil Enigma, and then I saw something else. So we're really focused on this character, Tom Bombadil, and the Enigma. I can't think of a character in all of Tolkien, in all of Tolkiendom, in all of Middle Earth, the Middle Earth Legendarium, who is more enigmatic than Tom Bombadil, mm-hmm. you know, Tom Bombadil is. And so in this article, you're exploring that. You warn at the beginning that you're going to be engaging in some moderate to severe Tolkien nerditis here. So but this is the place for some, you know, for the severe form of Tolkien nerditis, you know, for sure. So all of that is welcome here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you start out by introducing, you know, this figure of Tom Bombadil. And for anyone who's read The Lord of the Rings, like you said, you know, we're going to be familiar with this character. Maybe some people have latched onto him as more mysterious than others. He tends to be a character that everybody who likes Tolkien or anybody who reads The Lord of the Rings has a strong opinion on. Some people are just like, I don't even know why those three chapters are in there at all. And some people probably like you and me and Greta are like, well, why didn't Peter Jackson include Tom Bombadil in the movies at all? It's like a huge problem with his version of Fellowship. So you have this big spectrum of people when it comes to, you know, opinions of Tom Bombadil, but he is truly an enigmatic and trying to figure out where he comes from, who he is. There's a lot going on here, and so there's been a lot of controversy about him. What do we know from the text, Keith, about Tom? Like, what are some of the things that he says about himself? What are some of the things that the text says about him, that Goldberry says about him? I mean, we also got to just talk about Goldberry as a figure as well.
And how, what an awesome name, too. I mean, they're fantastic characters.
No, but both of them are enigmatic. Yeah. You really have to treat the two together. I think the first thing that's noticeable about Tom is the singing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing that seems to strike you when they first encounter him. That they hear him before they see him, and they hear this singing, and it's this somewhat nonsensical type of song. It reminds me a lot of the elves songs, the first time you encounter them in The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
Just the tra-la-la-lally down in the valley type of silly syllables. And it's throughout the dealings with Tom in the initial encounter, he's either singing, or even when he's speaking, it's a very rhythmic, almost song-like prose when he's speaking. But he has a strange combination of characteristics. His height is described, it's somewhere between, it's about the size of a dwarf, I think, because he's taller than a hobbit, shorter than a man, so he's dwarf size. His clothing is just unusual because of the bright colors. He has a feather in his cap, like hobbit sheriffs, and you know whether that's significant or not, I don't know, but he sings like the elves, the silly type songs in the hobbit things. He has powers that are really what is the most enigmatic thing about him, because despite all of the strangeness, it's the effect or non-effect of the ring on him that really strikes most readers. This ring, Gandalf doesn't even want to touch it. He doesn't want anything to do with it. We know he's very powerful. Galadriel, same issue. Tom is playing with this thing like it's a toy, puts it on his finger. He doesn't disappear. When Frodo puts it on, he can still see Frodo. It doesn't affect that. And so I think that's what really gets people's interest started in him, is the influence or lack of influence of that ring. That's such a key thing in this whole story, influencing everybody else. And then the hobbits start to ask these questions. Frodo asks Goldberry, who is he? He is.
Yeah.
And when I'm reading that, I hear him saying, who is Tom Bombadil? And he is. That answer has caused people to raise questions about, is he deity of some kind?
Yeah.
And
so just having like a similarity to like in scriptural terms, I am who am, is the, you know, how God refers to himself in the book of Exodus.
Yep. Right. That Exodus passage, I am, that's caused some people to latch onto that. Then she repeats, he's master, wood, water, and hill. He's master. And then, of course, when Frodo asks who he is, one of the most enigmatic answers in the whole thing, who are you, master? Don't you know my name yet? That's the only answer. Tell me, who are you alone, yourself and nameless? And I'm still wrestling with what he's getting at in that response. He starts to describe himself and He takes himself back to the very origins of Middle Earth in his description of what he's seen and experienced. So, of course, then at the Council of Elrond, Gandalf and all the elves have comments about him, but his characteristics are all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from looking like a hobbit to being the size of a dwarf, singing like an elf, and then all these enigmatic words by him and about him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the very, you know, curious responses by himself and Goldberry. I mean, it just deepens the mystery.
Yeah.
You know, Keith, as I was listening to you speak, the one word that popped into my head that I felt like would really describe Tom Bombadil was otherworldly. Like he doesn't seem to fit in Middle Earth. Like he's like above it, in it, but he's just kind of another world. Like he's just, you know, it's like he's in it, but he's not in it. Like, you know, he fits, but he doesn't.
And as I was reading it, you know, we talked about Tom, but, and then we kind of laughingly, just a few minutes ago, referred to Goldberry and the enigma that she is as well alongside him. And then you have Old Man Willow, right? And the enigma that Old Man Willow is in the old forest, and the interaction between Tom and Old Man Willow. and then you just have the Old Forest all by itself, at, like, is the place where they all seem to inhabit. It's almost like this is some kind of special place, you know, within the larger world of Middle Earth, that it's some kind of,
yeah, like an island,
like strange Garden of Eden or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Not
yes.
quite, not exactly paradise, but you know,
close.
Like, but you know, like a maybe kind of twisted paradise or something. I don't know, but yeah.
And I think people like Joseph Pierce have picked up on that.
Yeah.
And when he connects Bombadil and Goldberry with unfallen Adam and Eve in the midst
right.
of that messed up forest.
Right. Yeah. Which would explain why the ring doesn't mm-hmm. have an effect on him, right? I mean, they're immune to the effects of fallen man, of
yeah.
the you know, the results of the fall.
Yeah.
So there's yeah, there's
yeah, I mean the ring is certainly the most startling, like his relationship with the ring is certainly the most startling thing about him, the thing that stands out the most. And then you have because nobody has that reaction to the ring within the whole story. I mean, you can argue that some of the, you know, maybe the eagles would or the Ents would or something like that, but they never, it never really comes up for them. Like, it never really comes up for those, you know, for those types of beings. But yeah, Tom is just, there's no effect, you mm-hmm. know, it,
yeah.
it does not. It's not even a scary thing for him. It's just kind of like, this is nothing to me, you know, and for everybody else, it's everything. Yeah. And at the Council of Elrond, as you mentioned, he's also, you know, he's given some interesting names as well. You mentioned in your article, he's known at, for example, he's called by the elves as Yarwain Ben Adar, meaning oldest and fatherless, which is also one of those names that just leads you to think like, who is mm-hmm. this? Right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially, it becomes even more curious when you run into Treebeard and he's calling himself the oldest living thing, and the others are saying that about him. Well, who's the oldest?
Right.
Well, and speaking of Treebeard, because of the effect that makes me think of the effect that Tom has on Old Man Willow, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, Old Man Willow seeming to be this, you know, tree that is somehow animated, right, in a more human-like way. It seems to have more of a personality than your average tree, and that, of course, makes us think of the Ents. And so, is there some kind of relationship between them? And then Tom Bombadil has that power over Old Man Willow, right? He has the power to basically mm-hmm. command Old Man Willow.
And I haven't seen anybody write, I'm sure somebody has, but I haven't run across anybody writing anything substantive relating, theorizing that maybe Tom is related to the Ents in some way, but there are similarities there. Both of them are these, in the story, these singular figures within the midst of these forests. And I think, if I recall correctly, Gandalf, at the very last reference to Bombadil in the book, says something about Treebeard and the Ents. When he says he's going to go talk to him,
mm-hmm.
but
yeah,
it's another thing. He's similar to dwarves, men, hobbits, elves, Valar, Maiar, Ents, you name it. He's a mixture of everything, it seems like, or at least somewhat, he has similarities with everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yet in a way he seems above them because he's
yeah.
master.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting combination.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Well, so Keith, one of the best things about your article is that you do a really great job of going through and talking about some of the various theories, right? Some of the, like, I would say you probably catalog anything that anybody's come up with, you know, for the most part. You know, I'm sure maybe there's some other, because there's been so much ink spilled on this, that there's other little ones out here, like slight variations on certain theories. You know, walk us through some of these theories that others have suggested to explain who Tom is and where he comes from.
Well, as we were talking about earlier, there have been those who've suggested that he is God incarnate, Eru incarnate in some way, the omnipotent supreme being in the legendarium.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some have suggested that he and Goldberry are, you know, among the Valar, that And the most common theory is Aule and Yavanna, that they are Tom and Goldberry in disguise, mm-hmm. or Aule is in disguise and Tom and Yavanna is in disguise in Goldberry. And there was a time several years ago where I really thought that might be the best answer to this. I'm much less convinced of that. I think there's more serious problems with that. Some, like Robert Foster in his little dictionary, suggested he's one of the Maiar, and that's, you find that theory in various forms out there. Some have pointed out that in the print version of the Silmarillion, the published Silmarillion, as well as some of the earlier versions of it, Tolkien mentions other types of spiritual beings who came into Middle Earth along with the Valar and the Maiar. And there's been a number of variations on that, of different types of spiritual beings. And in the earlier writings in The Lost Road and things, he lists a large number of those kinds. That gets narrowed down by the time you get to the published Silmarillion, as you know, but it still opens the door to other types of spiritual beings. A nature spirit has been a common theory, and that I think is similar. It's a branch of that previous one, and that goes all the way back to a letter he wrote in 1937 when he's talking about the original poems regarding Tom Bombadil. Some of the more recent theories that I've seen become a little more abstract, where some have suggested he's the incarnation of Arda, that he is an incarnation of Earth itself, and that ends up being rooted in some things said about him at the Council of Elrond, you know, tying him to the power of the Earth itself. And then there's a fascinating theory that he's an incarnation of the music of the Ainur, and that is tied in with the predominance of singing that's related to him. Then there have been some more what I would call breaking of the fourth wall type theories, where some have the theory that he's Tolkien himself I've seen mentioned in comments mm-hmm. before, but I've never seen a full-blown article about it. I'm sure one's out there. Others that are like that, some have said that Tom represents the reader or the audience of the story, and I've seen at least one presentation of that that's enormous, a really long one. One of the strangest theories I've run across, and I've only seen one blog post really or website arguing this, is that he's not a good guy, that he's actually an evil spirit and he's waiting for the downfall of Sauron.
I was shocked when I read that in your article. I was like, really? There's somebody that thinks that? And I think you do a pretty good job of refuting that.
I think that's among the easily refutable theories.
I suppose somebody had to suggest that, you know, possibility, but it's
you need
it just
devil's advocate in there somewhere.
Yeah, it
right?
just doesn't seem to hold much water at all.
And I'm not 100% sure if that website isn't tongue-in-cheek. I can't quite tell if it's satire.
Yeah.
But I think some people might take it seriously, so I just mentioned it just in case. And of course, there are those who say that Tolkien put him in there and he's deliberately an enigma that's unsolvable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
They're all like, as I was reading through them, I kind of, you know, I would read one and be like, oh, that, yeah, I was kind of thinking about that. And then you'd mention something else, like, oh, yeah, well, that makes sense too. And then we got to the one about it possibly being Tolkien. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's what I want it to be. That's the one I was rooting for. I was like, I loved that idea, like a cameo in his own legendarium.
Well, let's talk about that one for a second. And, you know, I think you spoke about this and you referred to, you made a connection to this and Leaf by Niggle, if memory serves.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Right.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I don't, in my opinion, I don't think Tom represents Tolkien, mm-hmm. but I wanted to just say that I don't think you can rule it out as impossible, like the evil bad guy theory, because of something like Leaf by Niggle, where you do seem to have Tolkien at least playing with the possibility of entering into this subcreated world after death in Leaf by Niggle. It's hard to tell whether Niggle's entering into his own subcreation or whether in the afterlife God has created this thing for mm-hmm. him to enter into. It's a little fuzzy, but he seems to play with that, and who could blame him? You know, he spends his whole life creating this amazing world that, with so much beauty in it, as well as danger. But the thought of him wanting to enter into it, I don't think is beyond the realm of possibility.
No, not at all. Yeah.
But when he, in his letters, when he does talk about any character being most like him, I think Faramir is the one he most closely relates himself to, which is why I don't think it's Tom Bombadil is Tolkien, but I don't rule it completely out. I can see him with a twinkle in his eye playing that kind of joke on his readers.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's, I think that kind of leads us into the next, you know, portion of your article where you speak about the history of Tom Bombadil, not just as a figure in the history of Middle Earth, but as a creation of Tolkien's, right? As this storytelling figure that predates even even The Hobbit and a lot of the stories of the Legendarium. So you know, this was a figure that existed outside of Middle Earth for Tolkien for a long time. So tell us a little bit about that.
Right, and I think that does play a large part in what you were saying earlier about him seeming kind of otherworldly, because he existed in a non-Middle Earth world prior to the writing of The Hobbit and so forth. He wrote, as you know, Tolkien wrote stories for his children. We see the little Rowandum story about the lost dog, just beautiful and fun little story. The Hobbit's originally written in, or perhaps orally told to his children before it goes into print, and these poems about Tom Bombadil that are written that already include Goldberry and Old Man Willow and the Barrow-wight, that little world already exists before he writes The Hobbit, long before he writes Lord of the Rings. So it's already there, but it's not part of the Legendarium. It's a separate thing, like the Father Christmas letters or Rowandum or some of the other little short fictional stories he wrote.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to ask a quick clarification question. Now, this was a poem. Is that correct, that Tom Bombadil first appeared in? Did I read that correctly? Or no? Was he in a story?
Right. Yeah, that original version, the little story of Tom Bombadil, was written in poetic form.
Okay.
At least the version I have is in poetic
form. Okay. So it was a story, not a poem, but it was a story written in poetic form where Bombadil first appeared. Is that correct?
Back in the 30s.
Okay. Yeah, I did not realize that.
Actually, it might have been earlier than that.
I did not even realize that he was created, you know, so much before.
It was published in 1934.
Okay.
The Adventures of Tom Bombadil. His son has a little doll with the clothing and colors of Tom Bombadil, and he writes this silly, kind of fun, childlike poem story about this character that is his son's doll. Later, after The Lord of the Rings is published, he writes some additional poems and then publishes all that together, kind of draws it into the Legendarium by making it part of the Red Book of Westmarch, some selections out of it written by...
Okay. Yes, thank you for clarifying that. I did not realize. I just didn't realize that he had a history that predated Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, as Keith was saying, he's this figure that, you know, was kind of a story. Like, it was almost like it was just a, you know, kind of a playful thing with his kids for a long time. As so much of the Legendarium, you know, began as.
And then when you start reading the history of the writing of The Lord of the Rings, where he basically just starts writing it, seems, according to Christopher Tolkien, doesn't really know where this story is going.
Right.
I think it explains why it starts the way it does. And he says in a letter, and Christopher Tolkien mentions this in the History of Middle Earth, that he inserts these characters he had already invented decades earlier because he needed an adventure along the way for the hobbits.
I love that expression.
Yeah, he takes that little world of Tom Bombadil and Goldberry and the Old Man Willow and the Barrow-wight plops it right in the path of the hobbits, and they walk into the Old Forest and run into Tom Bombadil.
Yeah. But you also make the comment that, that's not the only place that Bombadil appears in Lord of the Rings. I mean, he keeps kind of, his name keeps popping up throughout the books. And even at the end, you know, there's a dream that Frodo remembers having had it, you know, at Bombadil. So it's not like that's an isolated, those three chapters are not, they're not like a standalone kind of.
Yeah, it's not an easy break between them. Like they, right. He's definitely spoken of at the Council of Elrond, you know, a good bit, and he's actually proposed as, let's just give the ring to Tom. Give the ring to Tom because it apparently has no effect on him, and maybe it'll just be safe. You know, maybe it'll just be safe until, you know, until the end of the world there, right? But that actually serves to refute the idea that he is, and that he's like a Iluvatar or even a Valar, because their basic response is, well, yes, it'll probably be safe there, safer than it would be in a lot of places, but eventually even Tom will succumb to, you know, will succumb to Sauron, right?
I think more than one of them say the ring has no power over him, but he has no power over the ring.
Right.
Which I think that rules out Eru, you know, the mm-hmm. god figure in the Middle Earth legends,
mm-hmm.
because surely the creator would have power over the creation.
Over all of his creation.
Beings.
Yeah, exactly.
But he is mentioned a few other times, not a lot, but in mm-hmm. Shelob's lair, mm-hmm. Sam, I sure wish Tom was here. And, mm-hmm. and the fascinating thing there is that immediately after that statement, they remember the little vial of light that Galadriel gave them. And then, of course, at the end with Gandalf, he's going to talk to them. I've been looking everywhere to see if that statement about he's a stone gathering moss and I've been a rolling stone, if there's anything anywhere that would tie that in as a clue, but haven't found anything yet. And then, of course, when Frodo finally crosses the sea into the west, that vision that he describes echoes the dream he had in the House of Bombadil.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we've gone through all of the other theories that have been proposed, and you spend a little time. I'll say this before we dive into your particular theory that you put forward in this article, you spend a little time with some of these other theories, and you divide them up into basically two types of theories and talking about them.
Right. I just, for the sake of classification, I divided them into theories where Tom breaks the fourth wall.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be theories such as he is Tolkien or the reader or the audience that brings the outside world into Middle Earth. And the other type of theories are those where Tom exists entirely within Middle Earth itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I that's just an easy way for me to remember the different types.
Sure,
of
to group them together. Because I mean, we listed off 10 or 11, you know, different, mm-hmm. Different variations. And so it helps to group them like that. And I wanted to say, just in case there are those who aren't familiar with that idea of breaking the fourth wall, I'm sure many listeners are, but there's probably some who aren't. Basically what you're describing, Keith, is this idea that, sometimes in a story, a character will speak to the audience. That's kind of like the most well-known way, where it's just like you're like watching a movie and then all of a sudden it's like everything's happening in kind of the three-dimensional world of the movie, and then all of a sudden one of the characters turns towards you and the audience and starts speaking to you directly, right?
Yeah, Ferris Bueller's Day Off or mm-hmm. Deadpool, those type of movies where the audience is constantly being brought into this, and in some ways it's breaking the illusion and playing with that.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
you know, they step out of Ferris Bueller steps out of his little world and addresses you. Deadpool steps out of the Marvel universe and addresses the audience, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Almost be like a stagehand becoming part of a play.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, and exactly. And so this would be something very like you're basically saying, like, with the theory that he's Tolkien, or the theory that he is actually the reader or the audience, that would be these kind of fourth wall, breaking the fourth wall types of theories.
Right, where our world breaks into the world of Middle Earth.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah.
Intersects with it.
Yes.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. Let's talk about what you put forward as your theory. So you spend a good kind of you spend a lot of time dealing with other people's theories and tracing the history of this character. Now, but you have a unique take on this, and so tell us about that.
So can I give you a timeout?
Sure.
Super quick.
Yeah.
I just wanted to back up a teeny bit, because one thing I really appreciated about your article, Keith, was how you mentioned a lot of the letters that you brought in, a lot of letters that Tolkien himself had written, and things that he specifically said about Bombadil. And I was curious if there is, I feel like after I read through those, I was like, well, that's clear as mud now. Thanks, Tolkien. Like, we've just complicated the issue further. We've done nothing but cleared up. But I was just wondering, because I know you mentioned a lot of letters, but was there just one particular one that kind of, made a special impact on you, or one that kind of helped you further kind of develop your own theory, per se?
Yeah, I think the first one that's had me start thinking about this was, I believe it's letter 144, when he says, he basically identifies Tom with a vow of poverty, renouncing control, taking delight in things for themselves. And then he mentions that Tom's representing a natural pacifist view.
Mm-hmm.
Vow of poverty and pacifism is what immediately started the wheels turning in my mind. But it wasn't enough for me to really think, that's not conclusive, because in other letters he said to represent and embody other things. But based on knowing a little bit of church history, that got the wheels turning. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other letter that was very significant for what I ended up doing was one that's not found in his published letters, but one that's found in the Lord of the Rings Reader's Guide, edited by Hammond and Scull, that it wasn't what got me started, but it was a major piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. So those were the two, I think, that started. And then the one where... he says, letter 142, when he says the Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, unconsciously so at first, but consciously in the revision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that the religious element is absorbed into the story and the symbolism. All of these comments he's making in these letters were coming together in my mind and really influenced the direction my thought was taking on this. Where I went.
Gotcha. With it. Yeah. Gotcha. Very cool. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, so that leads right in then to our, to your theory, right? So you've kind of hinted at some of the ideas that you put forward. So tell us, lay it all out here for us, your theory on maybe not exactly who Tom Bombadil is, but how we can better understand who he is.
Yeah, I think that, based on what he says in letter 142, where he says that certain religious elements are absorbed into the story and that it's fundamentally a religious and Catholic work, consciously in the revision. Most readers know that Tolkien was devoutly Roman Catholic, but what I wanted to start exploring as I was preparing this and thinking about it was whether that had any implications for Bombadil. Mm-hmm. And I started running across some of these things that I mentioned in the letter. Some I had already read, they were just in the back of my mind. But I think that Bombadil and Goldberry are characters that do absorb certain specific elements of Tolkien's Roman Catholic religion into them, and they represent something that I think Tolkien believed was important to represent in Middle Earth, but he couldn't do it explicitly. Because in the Third Age, that's thousands of years before the Christian Age, you couldn't put it in there in any explicit form.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, and then that's where all these other pieces started to come into play. In letter 144, he speaks about a vow of poverty and pacifism. Mm-hmm. In letter 153, he talks about Bombadil representing a spirit coeval with the natural mind and love of nature and so forth. And Tom in the story itself is constantly associated with music and singing. Those things immediately in my mind reminded me of the Franciscans and St. Francis of Assisi and the Franciscan order, because that's what that order, and he even more specifically was known for, his radical vow of poverty, his pacifism, his love of nature, and for his merry, almost frivolous, jolly singing.
Yeah.
if you read G.K. Chesterton's biography of Francis, it's almost hard to imagine that Tolkien didn't read that biography and have that in his head when he was writing some of this. And I think that's all a lot of circumstantial evidence. And I had just been mulling that over for years, but really not knowing what to do with it. And then the thing that finally made me think maybe I can put this into an article was when I was thinking about the use of dates in The Lord of the Rings, and how the Fellowship leaves, and Joseph Pierce was one of the ones who brought this up, where the Fellowship departs from Rivendell on December 25th. In the traditional Christian calendar, obviously that's the traditional date of the birth of Christ. The ring is destroyed on March 25th, which is the traditional date of the crucifixion. And so Tolkien seems to, at times, be playing with these dates as ways of absorbing a religious element into the story. And I started to wonder, could there be any significance to the dates associated with Tom? And I went back to Appendix B at the end of The Lord of the Rings and looked up what it said about Bombadil. And in the timeline, the hobbits meet Tom Bombadil on September 26th. And that didn't spark anything in my memory, but I went and started digging around, and lo and behold, I found out that September 26th for a long time was the traditional date of St. Francis's birth. And there are a number of sources out there that list it as the traditional date for his birth. So coincidence, possibly, but when you take that along with all the other things, it seems like maybe there's something more to this. Where they encounter him is the date of Francis's birth, and all these things he says in the letter and characteristics of him that look so much like Francis, started to add up. And then I started looking at Goldberry, and there are interesting things there. He's always portrayed, he's bringing her white lilies the first time they see him. And if you go back into the early medieval period, white lilies are commonly used as symbols of the Virgin Mary. I've gone back and looked at all these medieval artworks, and in the medieval paintings of the Annunciation, where Gabriel's announcing to her the coming birth of Christ, there's always these pots at her feet with white lilies in them. And then, you know, when you encounter Goldberry for the first time in the House of Bombadil, she's got all these lilies at her feet, and Tom's bringing her more. So maybe if Tom absorbs some kind of Franciscan spirituality or Franciscan element, Goldberry perhaps absorbs a Marian element, which might explain why Tom is just completely devoted to Mary, because that's another feature of Franciscan theology, is they are at the top of the list in terms of devotion to Mary. That's the Franciscans. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then other things I started to notice, Goldberry's song as they approach the house, she says, "Let's sing this song of sun, stars, moon, and mist, rain and cloudy weather," and so forth. And it occurred to me, you know, one of Francis's most famous songs is the Canticle of the Sun. Mm-hmm. And that whole song is about sun, stars, moon, and mist, and so forth. Is she calling them to sing the Canticle of the Sun in some weird symbolic way? And then one of the other things that I didn't notice until very recently when I was rereading the story for this semester's class is in the chapter on the Old Forest, when Frodo and they're walking through the forest, they're getting extremely discouraged, and then they see a hill, this treeless hill in the distance, and Tolkien describes it as rising like a bald head out of the encircling wood, and the path seemed to be making directly for it. And then just a few sentences later, he says, "The wood stood all round the hill like thick hair that ended sharply in a circle round a shaven crown."
Having I know that haircut.
Thinking about this, you know what, where I'm going with this. Yep. That's that medieval tonsure where they wear the ring of hair around
that Francis himself would have sported.
I had never noticed that before until after I'd written this and started thinking about this. I thought, well, okay, these hobbits are walking through this creepy old forest. They see a hill. Tolkien describes it as looking like the head of a monk. What in the world is that all about? Maybe Tom Bombadil's the answer to that question in some way. So I'm not, I should make it clear, I'm not saying that Bombadil is Saint Francis or Gabriel. I'm not saying that Goldberry is Mary or Saint Clair of Assisi, but I'm wondering if, I'm thinking there's a possibility that these two characters are allowing Tolkien to bring something, in a particular type of spirituality, into the story that he can't put in it explicitly. Mm-hmm. And do so in a very fun way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's brilliant.
I do too. You say Tom then might be the embodiment or representative of something Tolkien believed was needed in the story, a particular aspect of Roman Catholic spirituality exemplified by the Franciscans, specifically poverty, pacifism, a love of nature, and a penchant for joyful song. Yeah, I mean, at some point, you know, you get all these coincidences, right? And at some point, all the coincidences start to seem kind of like some kind of conspiracy, right? How many coincidences do we need to, at some point, say something's going on here? Like something is pointing in, you know, in a specific direction here. That thing about the hill being the bald head, you know, the tonsure is that's brilliant. I mean, you know, and it does seem that's exactly how Tolkien describes it there, you know, is that famous Franciscan haircut.
I've read that a dozen times and never noticed it.
Yeah.
So Tom like lives on this tonsured head of a hill, you know, basically.
Yeah. And I don't know if he lives on that hill, but they saw that hill and then they encountered Tom.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you know, just the fact of where this happens in the story. I mean, he makes a point of saying that they were becoming discouraged and, you know, worn down. And Frodo even thinks about turning around, like he's ready to throw in the towel. And then lo and behold, here comes Tom. And, you know, and it has a very, it's definitely a source. It ends up being a source of refreshment and encouragement to the party. And I think there's a lot of people out there who, you know, who find a lot of comfort and peace in the writings of St. Francis and, you know, in the different visions that, or, you know, apparitions or been of Mary. And in just knowing what we know about Tolkien, I feel like it just makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. And just where they live has a very just calming, like almost a monastic type of feel to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's like a retreat house.
Exactly.
You know?
And
Keith, you're reading your article and reading this section on St. Francis made me think one other thing, brought one other thing to mind for me. And it's a biographical note for Tolkien, of course. His basically father figure for most of his childhood was not his biological father, but it was a Catholic priest named Father Francis. And so now Father Francis was not a Franciscan, but the name Francis, if you're going to be given the name Francis after, you know, after the existence of St. Francis of Assisi as a Catholic, then that name somehow harkens back to St. Francis of Assisi. He was that big a role, that big a figure in the history of Christianity. And so that's just another thing that made me think, like, you know, Tolkien was, it seems clearer and clearer that Tolkien, that Tom Bombadil wasn't necessarily like created to be St. Francis, but that he became a Franciscan figure over time and the development of Tolkien's own thought and writings. And and maybe in part he was also a tribute to this, you know, this man who was, you know, the father that that Tolkien you know, the biological father, you know, the father figure that Tolkien needed and didn't have because his biological father passed away when he was so young.
Yeah.
So
exactly. And I feel like it also serves to support, you know, the fact that the ring has no power over him. 'Cause we have a good friend who's a Franciscan, actually. And I still remember this one time where he was...
Can I read something? I'm going to interrupt you because I need to interject something here.
Okay.
All right. So
don't
here's,
let me forget
here's
what I was
going really,
to say because it's important.
No, I'm actually going to mention that. So,
oh, you are. Okay.
So, Keith, I wrote a book on music and, you know, in Middle Earth, and I actually specifically wrote a chapter on Tom Bombadil in that chapter because he has such an interesting relationship with music. And I think a couple of years ago we talked about Tom, but we went chapter by chapter through Lord of the Rings, so I'm sure there were several chapters it's all a blur now, but I know we had that conversation you were about to bring up about our friend who is a Franciscan friar, and that kind of story found its way into my book. I'm going to read what I'd written here, and I think it's what... Or do you want to...
No, no, no. You go ahead.
All right. So he says...
Stealing my thunder. Can you believe this, Keith?
Well, I was planning on working this in, and I got to work in a plug for my book, you know? even though this is about Keith and not about
me.
But this... It's from the section titled Tom versus Sauron's Ring. And it says, perhaps it is that Tom is the embodiment of the carefree song. A good number of his songs are silly, so much so that many readers find Tom annoying, yet he is incredibly powerful all the same. Though great figures like Gandalf, Elrond, and Galadriel shudder from the temptation of Sauron's ring, Isildur's bane has no effect on Tom. How can this be? In a 1954 letter to Naomi Mitchison, Tolkien elaborated on Tom's purpose in Lord of the Rings. Though he first refers to Tom as being not an important person to the narrative, he nevertheless insists that he would not have left him in if he did not have some kind of function. Tolkien goes on to elaborate about the moral philosophy underlying the Lord of the Rings, yet finally admitting that the desire for control is one that even the good guys are highly susceptible to. He speaks then of a vow of poverty, implying that Tom has taken something along those lines. Here we go. I have a good friend who is a Franciscan friar. We have a good friend who is a Franciscan friar, an avowed follower of the way of life modeled by St. Francis of Assisi. One of the vows he took when he became a Franciscan was a vow of poverty. Just what is the nature of such a vow? In essence, it is a refusal to take hold of anything with one's heart. I recall a moment when I saw the power of this vow in action. My friend, given the opportunity to accept some kind of gift, kindly refused it, making a suggestion about it. About who it could be given to. In a way, this vow was his richness. Possession of the gift threatened this vow, a vow which I saw in a stark spiritual moment brought him true happiness, true freedom, true peace, an inner harmony, if you will. Though my friend's reaction was not perfect, I could tell he still struggled to maintain the vow to some degree, which is, of course, to be expected. It nevertheless yielded great insight into the nature of such a vow. If we follow Tolkien's line of reasoning, Tom has fulfilled this vow perfectly and no longer must struggle to maintain it, if ever he did struggle. So that whole thing of the vow of poverty was something that I resonated with me on kind of that same frequency. You do a much more thorough and better job of developing this question of the Franciscan relation. I mean, some of these, you know, the Tonsured Hill, the date of the significance of September 26th being the date that they meet Tom Bombadil, and that being the traditional feast day of St. Francis of Assisi. You know, I guess all I'm trying to say is it looks like great minds think alike on this, Keith.
Yeah.
That's why one thing I mentioned somewhere, maybe in a postscript on that article, I'm positive others have caught some elements of this, if not the whole thing. I just haven't run across it developed fully yet.
Yeah,
Sure others have seen that vow of poverty comment and thought St. Francis, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and that was my only like kind of connection on it, was just, oh, vow of poverty. That's, you know, what Franciscans take. But like I said, you do you really actually show that may be much closer to the truth, right? This idea that Tom is almost like this avatar of a Franciscan spirituality.
I think he's a pre-Franciscan Franciscan. He's representing something that will later be more fully exemplified by Francis in that order, but it's something I think Tolkien wanted in the story somewhere, and Tom was able to, by using Tom, he's able to bring that element in, and it becomes a significant part of the story, I think. I disagree with those who think Tom can be just removed from the story with no effect to it. I think he does become an important part. Even though he's not mentioned a lot later, he is a significant part of the plot. Mm-hmm. At the very least, rescuing them from the Barrowites and giving them those swords that are later become very important.
Absolutely.
Nobody else in the story represents that complete detachment from possession mm-hmm. and desire for power and control as he does.
But mm-hmm. we know that that's such an important theme in the story. It may be the key theme of the whole, you know, of the whole story of Lord of the Rings is this question of that here's this powerful object that the one thing you can't do is take it for your own. The moment you take it for your own, and you try to possess it, you try to control it, that's the moment in which you're going to be owned by it, right? It's going to take possession of you. And so Tom really is hugely important in that sense because he shows that it's possible to not for it not to have an effect on an individual, even though we don't know why, you know, he's able to pull that off. But he's kind of like this, it's almost like he's an eschatological figure in a way. He both harkens back to before anything was in the world, but he also points towards like perfect freedom, you know, that they all long for. And all the figures in the story struggle with the temptation of the ring. You know, we see Frodo all throughout the story. And everybody seems to exist on that spectrum somewhere, right? Every figure seems to exist on the spectrum of how dangerous is the ring to them. Even with the hobbits, you know, you have Gollum who's completely given over to it. And then you have Bilbo who's more given over to it. Frodo, becomes more given over to it over the course of having it with him. And then Sam seems to be the most capable of being detached from it. Even though he's not perfectly, you know, capable of being detached from it. So,
In Faramir may be the closest among the regular characters, the closest to being able to do away with it. But even he, I think, experiences the temptation in his discussion with Sam and Frodo. He feels it, unlike which Bombadil doesn't even seem to feel it. He feels the pull. He knows the honor he could get from his father, at least briefly, but he is able to resist it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, Keith, this has been just a really fascinating discussion.
It's been great. I
love talking about Tom Bombadil. He's one of the best characters in the story. He's endlessly fascinating. And you know, part of it just feels like we just kind of scratched the surface on him.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, part of me is wondering, you mentioned at the beginning how we mentioned that he's very much missed from the Peter Jackson films. And part of me wonders, especially after this discussion, if that's just because like he Jackson just didn't want to get it wrong. Like he couldn't quite figure out who this was, what he was, how to portray him, you know. And part of me honestly is like, I don't know. I think I'd rather not see him at all than see it done wrong.
I feel like I've heard that. I feel like now that you say that, I feel like I heard that was actually Jackson's excuse. Was he was just kind of like, I didn't know what to do with Tom Bombadil. Like,
yeah.
I just didn't see how to
work
him in.
He's intimidating. Like, it's very, because, I mean, he's obviously, it's part of the enigma, right? He's great and he's small. I mean, you don't mm-hmm. quite know. Yeah, I just put myself in Peter Jackson's shoes, and I'm like, I don't even know how I would do this.
Like,
how could I do this right?
I got enough to figure out here. I can't figure out the enigma, you know.
It would be so easy to get him wrong and make mm-hmm. that very silly looking part of the film.
Yeah. It definitely would be very difficult for anybody to get that character right for sure. I'm gonna close with the last line from the article. here, not the very last line, but I thought this was really good. You say, Keith, Tom is a non-Middle-earth being who was drawn into Middle-earth. Tolkien knew this, but keeping Tom Bombadil in Middle-earth allowed Tolkien another means to do something he felt was necessary. It provided him a means by which he might absorb the Roman Catholic religious element that was so important to him personally into the story of the Lord of the Rings. You know, I love this idea because I'm a big fan of like, you know, all the like paranormal stuff, you know, in our own world and like, you know, what's going on with these weird stories of things that happen and they just don't make any sense. And there's no explanation for them, but there they are. The evidence is there for them. And it's almost like in this world, this fantasy world, Tom Bombadil is like a paranormal. He's like a paranormal figure in the fantasy world of Middle Earth. He's like, no one knows exactly what's going on with him and he doesn't actually make sense, but there he is.
Yeah.
And I think that was the fascinating thing about that letter in the Lord of the Rings Reader's Guide where Tolkien himself said, he really doesn't fit. He is otherworldly, like you were saying. He comes from a different world, and it just intersects with that world. And at the end of it, he says he's fatherless. He has no. Tolkien wrote, Tom Bombadil is fatherless. He has no historical origin in the world described in the Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He came in from outside, and so all the looking for his historical origin in that world might just be fruitless if what Tolkien says in that letter is what he actually meant to say. And that it's the stagehand peeking behind the screen. There is a fourth wall being broken in here, I think.
Yeah. It's like Tolkien was like, everything else is so organic in Middle Earth, and then all in Tolkien's just like, and I'm just gonna put him right here.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think that's the thing that has caused this to be debated for 50 years. Is, when you know how much he prized consistency,
right,
and how that kept him from ever finishing the Silmarillion, it's really hard to conceive of him leaving a character in that he knows isn't consistent.
Yeah,
exactly.
Tom Bombadil, the sunglasses come down slowly on Tolkien. Deal with it. All right. Well, cool. So your website is keithmatheson.org. And you actually have several other writings on Tolkienian topics. Do you want to maybe briefly mention a little bit about some of those other articles?
Well, the two that popped to mind initially is one I wrote about the Silmarillion, the endings, where I was looking at the endings of the Silmarillion, the earlier versions of the Silmarillion, and comparing those to the ending of the Quintosilmarillion in the published version.
Mm-hmm.
And arguing that we might be able to make a case that this might be because Christopher mentions that there are some things he regretted in the editing, and I'm just throwing out there the possibility that maybe this is one that had he not pushed to finish that thing so quickly, it might have been worth considering keeping the bulk of the original ending with the second prophecy of Mandos.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one I wrote, which probably caused more aggravation to people than any of them, is my one about my thoughts on the Peter Jackson trilogy, where I just talk about the things I really love about it and the things that were more, we'll say, just problematic in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So those two got some responses from people.
Gotcha. And just scrolling through, I'm seeing, you know, an article on Ainu Lindelöf, which you call Tolkien's most beautiful work. As well as an article on Mythopoeia and a comparison of Tolkien and Lewis. So lots of good stuff. Lots of good Tolkien stuff over here for our listeners to check out for sure.
Yeah.
So.
For our ravenous Tolkien fans.
Absolutely.
Yeah. More food for thought.
Well, fantastic. Well, Keith, thank you so much for joining us.
This has really been fantastic. Absolutely.
Thank you for inviting me.
And just thank you for the time you spent writing this article and researching it, putting it together. It's a really just an excellent, example of, I think, how to approach a topic like this and illuminate everybody and help us all understand what different people have said. And then, you know, introduce some new, thoughts and evidence into consideration and maybe help us arrive a little closer at what exactly is going on with Tom. So,
yeah, that's been great. Absolutely great.
Well, yep. Thanks a lot, Keith.
Thank you, Keith. It's great to see you.
Very much enjoyed talking to you.
Same. Same. Take care.
All right. Correspondence time.
Correspondence.
Yeah, that was kind of a that was a pretty long interview, so we're going to keep the correspondence short and sweet this week. But the good thing is we got some fun correspondence.
Oh, good.
Kind of correspondence I like, which is pretty much just uninhibited praise of how awesome this podcast is. So
that's my favorite too.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's definitely the you know the feedback. It's just nice and simple just to hear praise and, you know, not have to use the noggin sometimes.
Yeah.
So,
but no, we're not vain or anything, but it's nice to be reminded now and then of how awesome we really are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not vain at all, but, yeah,
not vain.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So first off, we are going to, mention a couple of recent iTunes reviews. So first off on October 28th, we had doink doink 123 dollar sign.
That's awesome.
Awesome name.
That's so good.
Said amazing 5 stars. The best podcast I've ever listened to. I would definitely recommend you listen to it. Plus, it's better than any other Tolkien podcast.
Whoa!
Boom.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's my favorite kind of review right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Short, sweet, to the point.
And telling us how awesome we
are. Full of praise.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, doink, doink. $123 sign.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Yes.
We really appreciate this.
And they have
an
awesome name, too.
I know.
What is it called? Is that like a handle or is it is it just an iTunes name? What is it? Does it have a special name?
Handle's fine.
Handle.
Yeah.
Okay. I like that.
Doink, doink, 123.
Yep.
Yeah.
Good.
So, yeah, thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you for the kind words. And there was another review on October 29th from Proud Dad MCal via Apple Podcasts. Rediscovered my love of Tolkien, 5 stars. I'm 27 episodes into this podcast and the in-depth look into each and every chapter, starting with the Silmarillion. And now The Lord of the Rings has truly helped me rediscover my childhood love for everything Tolkien. And for that, I thank you.
Oh. That's great.
Awesome.
I know that's one of the things we, you know, that we strive for here on the podcast.
Yeah.
Just, you know, either keeping that love going or reigniting it or helping people discover it. So.
Yeah. I always love getting those kind of notes when folks share with us that it's, you know, we've helped to rekindle their love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's if we can get you back in touch with Tolkien, you know, we feel like we've done a good job.
Yeah.
So
it's a good day's work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Proud Dad.
Thank awesome. You very much, Proud Dad
yes.
and Cal. All right. We also have a shout out over here on Twitter from Carlo Marx. Carlo Marx.
Carlo.
Carlo.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Carlo says, at Tolkien Road, rereading The Hobbit and then Lord of the Rings. Been 20 years. Found your podcast to go over each chapter. Good stuff. Thanks.
Yay.
Awesome.
Cool beans.
Indeed. Very awesome. Thank you so much, Carlo. We really appreciate hearing from you. All right. And then last but certainly not least, double check my list here. Last but certainly not least is from Jonathan D., one of our amazing patrons.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Jonathan.
Hello, Jonathan. Jonathan said, hey guys, hope y'all are doing well. I just wanted to drop a note after listening to the latest episode. Before listening to the Tolkien Road, I would have considered myself someone who liked Tolkien. But after listening to your show and reading the Silmarillion, which was much aided by your show, I am someone who loves Tolkien. Thank you for expanding my knowledge of the man and his writings. Keep up the great work.
Awesome.
Boom. That's what I'm talking. Jonathan knows where I'm coming from.
Yeah, clearly. Well, he probably just felt the need to, you know, let you know that he's moved from like to love just to so that you wouldn't like depatronize him. Probably.
Why would I ever do that?
Because if he's just a liker, I mean, I don't know. I don't know where the wrath ends.
If you're a patron, I automatically assume you're a Tolkien lover, right?
Okay.
You know,
I guess that's fair.
So,
I guess that's fair.
That's, you know, that's what we're here to do. Like, look, I'm not out there to hate, you know, mere Tolkien likers. I'm here to say that that's what this podcast exists to do, is transform people who merely like Tolkien into people who love Tolkien.
Good. And right? Jonathan D is proof that we are on the right track.
Yeah. Cool. Total virtual air five to Jonathan B right now. So he knows, that guy knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, he does. Mm-hmm. Well, good stuff.
Absolutely.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you all so much. It's always nice to just have some praise, you know?
Yeah.
Just have people saying, you guys rock.
You guys rock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We appreciate that.
We do very much.
But we'd love to hear from you, whatever you got to say, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, wherever you want to hit us up and you can find us. We love hearing from you.
Yes, always.
All right. I think that about wraps up this episode, Greg.
Okay. All right. Cool. Well, that's it's probably good. It's been on the longer side.
Yeah, special thanks to our amazing patrons.
All of you are amazing.
All of you are amazing, and especially the following: Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Asya V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Matt L,
Johanna T,
Todd G,
Ms. Anonymous,
Sam N.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you all so much for being patrons. And thank you for listening.
Yes, all of you. We really, really appreciate it.
And we will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.